we charge up diesel trucks, and there's already 3 million of those on the road. We're talking 10x improvement in fuel economy. You show up at a Revoy swapping station. There's a stack of Revoy EVs. One pulls out, you drop your trailer, and it grabs the trailer for you, and it hops onto the back of your truck. That process takes 2 minutes. It's hard to sell a PowerPoint deck, so I built a 1/14th scale version of the product running on a treadmill. Basically, we want to be building the new renewable electricity infrastructure beyond just trucks. But trucks are the first thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was not expecting this. Hi, Ian. Welcome to Scaling Climate Tech.
Thanks for having me, Florian. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm very excited about the conversation today because we're going to talk about big and hard problems. We're going to talk about the decarbonization of trucking. So those huge semi-trucks we see on the highway, 80,000 pounds trucks that we have to decarbonize somehow. It's a massive industry. 3 million semis in the US on the road today. They account for a fourth of greenhouse gas emissions from transportation in the US. So that's a massive problem. I'm excited about this discussion because trucking falls into this category of hard to abate, where the exact solution hasn't been fully laid out yet. There are a few options still on the table. So I'd like to start talking about that. What are the decarbonization pathways? We're going to talk about hydrogen, electrification, maybe mobile carbon capture, different solutions that exist out there. Two, I'd love to talk about what you guys do at Revoy, which is around electrification of trucking, but with a very specific approach to it. And just to give the tagline, you're enabling trucking electrification, or at least 90% of trucking electrification at no upfront cost in only a few minutes.
That's right.
Yeah, so we'll
two minutes.
2 minutes. So we'll see how that's possible. And specifically, I'd like to understand what that means for trucking company, unit economics and value proposition for them. And we'll talk about how did you build this product? We'll go more into what your product is. It's a very complex piece of hardware. So how did you come about to build this technology?
Sounds good. Excited to talk about it.
Before anything else, Ian, could I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Ian Rust. I'm the founder and CEO of Revoy. Maybe just a little bit about my background. I'm a robotics engineer. I've spent my whole career in industrial automation, been out in the Valley for about 12 years now. Spent the plurality of my career in self-driving cars, so robo-taxis. I was the first engineer at Cruise. You know, there are definitely some through lines from that. We certainly aren't taking on the full autonomy problem. We often call our vehicle a semi-autonomous vehicle, and I get into what that means. But the focus right now is not for removing a driver. What we are focusing on is energy. How do we get off of diesel, and how do we get onto something that's renewable?
As I prepared this episode, I looked into the world of trucking, which, to be fair, I didn't know anything about. So I wanted to set the stage for everyone for this discussion on some background on this industry. As I mentioned, it's a massive industry, 3 million semis on the road today. There are a lot of small businesses in this industry. It's a very fragmented industry. Could you tell me a bit more about like some of the key facts people should know to understand the magnitude of this industry?
Yeah, it's a lot of small businesses. But funnily enough, when you look at the data on it, the median fleet size is actually still rather large. It's in the 100 to 200 truck range. It's just because there's a small group of really, really big fleets, like tens of thousands of trucks. Sometimes
the Amazon, the FedEx.
Yeah. Absolutely. And names that a lot of people haven't heard of, things like J.B. Hunt, that's one a lot of people know, Knight-Swift, Ryder. These are companies that are honestly fundamental to our economy. They move the stuff that all of us have in our homes and our offices. And yeah, I mean, that's one thing. A lot of people do have this conception that it's, you know, dominated by owner operators. I mean, if you certainly go by number of or by fleet count, right? A fleet of an owner operator is a fleet of one. And so there's a lot more owner operator fleets than there are mega fleets. But if you go by truck count, and ultimately, you know, when we're talking about an energy transition, truck count is a much better proxy for energy use because, you know, they tend to do the same number of miles per year. And miles ultimately are the big indicator. Ton miles, really, if we want to get in more detail, because it matters how much you're hauling. That's how much energy it takes. while we're on this train of thought of common misconceptions, another one that I think people have in their head is that trucking is dominated by short haul. There's this number that gets thrown around, you know, even Elon Musk said this on stage, you know, I think the number is 84% of trucking is under 250 miles. So that is true, but in a very, very narrow and what I would say inaccurate sense. And it's kind of similar to the, you know, most trucking fleets are owner operators. Well, that is true in a strict sense, but if we look at, you know, actual energy impact, you should be using a different metric. So the 84% number is actually by number of trips. So a 10-mile trip counts the same in that, you know, accounting as a 1,000-mile trip, right? But when we're talking about energy, right, 10 miles is a very different demand than 1,000 miles.
Got it. You're skewing your metrics by just the definition of the metric, just in the same way as the structure of the fleet.
Exactly. When you actually go and look at by what is the best proxy for energy use, ton miles, it's actually very much the opposite. The industry is really dominated by long haul, very long haul trips. And you talk to anyone in the industry, they'll tell you the same thing. It's all about long haul. Yeah, that's actually what makes electrification so challenging is short haul is what a lot of these vehicles can do, especially electric vehicles. And there is this misconception that that is sort of good enough to solve the problem, but it isn't.
Very interesting. So essentially you're saying that it's true if you look at number of trips, but if you look at energy used by heavy duty trucks, then we need to focus long distance.
Absolutely. And there's actually a lot of things about long distance make it a lot easier. So I really do feel like this focus on short haul is really a dead end that we're spending way too much time on. And yeah.
And so Elon would not be always right?
Not always. He's right a lot of the time, but in this case, no.
Okay, so let's focus on long haul. We talked at the beginning that it's one of those hard to decarbonize sectors. There are different pathways to do that. So there's three main pathways. One is electrification, essentially doing the same as what we're doing for individual cars. So using battery-powered trucks that can drive up to 300 miles today, more or less, for the Tesla Semi, for instance. Second one is hydrogen. A lot of hype around this, typically using compressed hydrogen in tanks and a fuel cell to power the electric drivetrain of that truck. And then there are other approaches, we'll call them, which tend to be less common. Some people are talking about synthetic fuels for the use of heavy-duty trucking. Some people are talking about mobile carbon capture. We actually had Paul Gross from Remora on this podcast, year ago. Paul is fantastic and also a very interesting approach to decarbonization of trucking. So maybe if we start with the first one, because that's probably where there is the most momentum today. Help me understand the pros and cons of electrification and where we are in terms of electrification of trucking today.
Yeah, I think a big reason why, you know, it really is on the top of the list for most people is it's what worked for passenger vehicles or what is ostensibly working for passenger vehicles. I do think we're still very much in the early days of that as well, but we're certainly well beyond where we're at with heavy trucks. I mean, the number is, you know, in this, I believe it's 7% adoption, you know, if we took a look at total vehicle counts of EVs in the passenger space, and it's 0.03%, less than 1,000 electric semi-trucks out there. So it's quite a bit earlier. Based on that success, it does seem to make a lot of sense. The price point, despite being quite a bit higher, is not ridiculously higher. There are charging networks, not really enough power for semi-trucks, but you know, we're starting to build charging networks. So there's definitely this sense of it's going to happen. It's just like passenger EVs, it's just going to kind of happen. The problem with that, in my opinion, is the heavy trucking market is just so different in a lot of fundamental ways. And I think that's why we haven't seen the same really high acceleration adoption. I mean, electric semis have been out in market for nearly a decade now. It's not a factor of availability of the product. I think it's actually the product itself. The main reason that it's really hard that passenger vehicles and commercial trucks have very different values to their owners. A passenger vehicle is not an asset. A commercial vehicle is. You know, no one expects a luxury sedan to net them an ROI. And that's really what the heritage of electric vehicles in the passenger space have been. I mean, I'm definitely very bullish on the affordable EV, and I do think we're right on the cusp of that. But when you kind of just copy paste that same tech stack over to something that has to be an asset, I mean, for example, an owner operator, they buy a truck and that is the piece of equipment that they earn their living on. Mm-hmm. And so if there's not an ROI on it, that could be a disastrous decision for that owner operator. I mean, they're taking out over $100,000 in debt for a diesel version. We're talking about three times that for an electric version.
So help me put that in context. Yeah. Let's say I'm an owner operator.
Sure.
I have a diesel truck that I've been having for 20 years that the life expectancy.
Yeah, 20, 30 years.
20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking at other options. So I can buy a new diesel truck for 100K. Is
that 130. I mean, it depends on how you load it out.
130K.
How many bells and whistles you have.
But okay.
Yeah, 130, 150. Yeah.
What is the cheapest electric truck I can buy right now?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you ask and what stage of development. Tesla claims they'll be able to get to 180,000. Mm-hmm. I have my skepticism about that. I mean, if you kind of see the way the pricing, for example, on the Cybertruck worked out, you know, that started out as 40K, ended up 100K. I think we're going to see a similar trend. I think the cheapest is in like the low 200s, but you're kind of average, and that's going to be very short range. Basically, what you're paying for is the batteries. I mean,
right.
Batteries are just so expensive compared to a diesel engine.
So let's call it a 200, 250K. I'm going to have fuel saving on that. How much would I spend typically on a year if I'm a long-haul trucker?
On fuel, $100,000. The real question on how much money you save is it really depends. So if you're looking at, for example, you know, you're paying 25 cents a kilowatt hour to 2.5 kilowatt hours per mile, that works out to, what is that, 55 to 65 cents per mile. That's the same price as diesel. And there's localities and times where you're paying 30, 40, 50 cents per mile, and it'll actually cost you more to charge it. And so in that case, it's really a lose-lose proposition. You're paying more upfront and you're paying more per mile. There's no way to get a break even there. You'll see why this is so important. I mean, when Tesla announced the Tesla Semi, one of the key bullet points there was guaranteed 7 cents per kilowatt hour sourced by solar. And that's a really key thing to have. Now, 7 cents per kilowatt hour, that is possible. I mean, with solar, you can get as low as 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. You look at CAISO electricity rates. I mean, that doesn't include transmission costs and peak demand charges, but ultimately solar is really dang cheap. I mean, that's why I think it's something like 50% of new electricity generation is solar.
So what you're saying is that depending on the retail market, the retail energy market you're playing in,
yes,
you might have a significant saving on electric if you're in a market that has 20 cents, 25 cents per kilowatt hour, is but not even, maybe
that's,
lower.
That's break even.
Maybe
yeah,
lower than
be
that.
Lower. Yeah.
15 cents kilowatt hour.
Yeah, yeah.
So you might get some savings there in those markets.
Yes.
But if you're in a high energy cost market, like California, for instance, above 20 cents, 25 cents, I think I paid something like 40 cents on my electric cars, you're not getting a saving. You might get a cost premium. And the second point you made is around, if you're not buying this electricity retail, like you are on a Tesla supercharger today or on a EVgo charger, you can get solar straight from the behind the meter, essentially,
yeah,
which can be a much cheaper option.
Much cheaper.
That is not something widely accessible today.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very good point. It's an accessibility problem because, I mean, the fundamentals, right? Like if you have in terms of you buy a solar panel, you direct it into a charger, you charge an EV, that can be very, very cheap. It's just sort of the practicalities of you got to build the solar and you got to transmit it. And that's where the pricing problems come in. And there's also the challenge around sort of the capital risk around the chicken egg problem of charging and vehicle adoption, which is a really, really important thing. Basically, you know, listeners are familiar with the Tesla supercharger network, why they built that. I mean, it was all about driving adoption of their passenger vehicles. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one's going to buy a electric car that they can't charge out in the world. I mean, it's obvious, right? And so they did that and, you know, that kind of unstuck that chicken egg problem. I think we still need to get better charger availability, especially outside of California, better charger uptime. We're still, I think, pretty early on that journey. But basically, you know, Tesla proved that you can do it. If you build the chargers, then people will adopt it and you can unstick it that way.
Yeah. And there are a few companies looking at that on the heavy duty side, right?
Absolutely.
Tesla is obviously one of them. TerraWatt infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So there's a few companies trying to say, let's get ahead of the chicken and egg problem, put those sizable amount of charger so that as an owner, I don't have this, or I have lesser of a concern in terms of charger availability. So we talked about cost, right? So there's this cost premium. My ROI depends on where I'm actually charging. Charging network availability. Do I have a charger on my route? Charging time is probably an issue as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And ultimately that gets down to, you know, utilization of the asset as well as driver hours, you know. right now, oftentimes fuel and driver wages sort of trade for that top spot in terms of, you know, per mile costs for trucking. Right now, driver costs are definitely higher. And so, yeah, I mean, what you're essentially doing is you're paying a guy to sit and wait for a vehicle to charge. And, you know, that can be 1, 2, 3, 4 hours. They only can drive 11 hours a day. So if you're eating into that, your utilization on both, you know, your workforce and your core asset, the vehicle, just really, really drop. I mean, Ryder, which is a major fleet, they actually put out a report on what they called the TCT, the total cost of transportation. And when you factor in specifically driver as well as payload impact, that's another thing. And, you know, the additional number of trucks you need, because one, you need to move more trucks to move the same amount of payload, but also you need more trucks because more are spending their day on the charger. You end up with, despite even with a, I believe they model out a, you know, 50% reduction in fuel cost and energy cost, you know, diesel to electric. Don't quote me on that, but that's about the number. You're looking at double the price, total cost of transportation.
Because of those knock-on effects.
Exactly.
On. And yeah. Are you seeing that as something that could be optimized? I was looking at the Tesla supercharger for semis. So the semi battery, I think, is a 1 megawatt hour, which is insane on its own. Just to give listeners a sense of how big that is, that's at least 12 times more than a Tesla Model Y, which on its own is already a massive battery. So a huge piece of equipment there that can carry energy. And Tesla Supercharger V3, I believe, is 250 kilowatts.
Mm-hmm. 4 hours.
So 4 hours, if you make it as simple. Is there a physical limit to making this charger be 1 megawatt, 10 megawatt charging capacity to be able to charge in a much faster?
Not on the charger side. I mean, it's just a wire, basically, right? Yeah. There's certainly the supply side. I mean, you know, if you're trying to do it in an hour, I mean, a megawatt is a commercial building, right? Like, yeah, you really have to think out your supply. The vast majority of sites, if not all, just don't have a spare megawatt lying around. So there's that side. You know, you have to source the electricity. The other challenge is definitely the effect of charge speed on battery cycle life. Definitely there's been, I think, a lot of progress on that. Like Tesla in particular, I think they really have managed to really decrease the impact of high C rates on the life of their batteries. But it is still a concern, in my opinion. And so what you're kind of doing in that case is you're making this trade-off between charge speed and asset utilization. You either charge it fast and maybe lop a couple hundred cycles off the back, or you charge it slow and you're paying your driver and you're waiting on the truck and et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of this rock and hard place type situation.
So it's not so much as the charger technology, which is the bottleneck, but it's more like the ability to supply a 10 megawatt to a single truck, which if you multiply by a 20 truck stop would be a 200 megawatt capacity for a given charging location.
Yeah, it's everything behind the charger that's the bottleneck for
Got it. Okay, so I have my truck. I'm still not convinced, or I'm concerned rather.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm interested by the savings, but there are some uncertainties. There are uncertainties on the charging time. There are uncertainties on the charging network.
Yeah.
I'll look into hydrogen then. Hydrogen has a lot of positive things going for it. There's a lot of momentum in the US, political support, subsidies. Yeah. There's a lot of infrastructure funding coming to it. It's still a very expensive fuel today.
Exactly.
Do you have some numbers on like how that would turn out in terms of return on investment for hydrogen? Because my understanding is that the truck itself, not necessarily much more expensive, but the operating costs to fuel with hydrogen can be much more expensive.
Absolutely. Yeah, I haven't checked the numbers in a little bit, but last I saw, I think it's, you know, in terms of gallon of diesel equivalent, it's like $20. So, you know, you take that, call it $4 a gallon at $100,000, you're looking at $500,000 in hydrogen costs. And that's what I personally think is the fundamental flaw of hydrogen. I mean, from a technical like perspective, hydrogen is awesome. The energy density is better than diesel. I think the main problem is mostly economic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you really need to believe that cost down that everybody's talking about.
Yes.
That we're not seeing too much happening yet will happen eventually.
You do need to then build hydrogen infrastructure, but I think that's a little bit, honestly, it really mimics oil and gas. You put a tank, you bring a truck out, you fuel it up. I think it's pretty natural, but I have big concerns about the ability for that cost curve to come down. I think you're basically running into the limits of, you know, physics and chemistry, and that's a pretty hard place to be in. Yeah.
I was looking at the numbers of zero emission trucks sold in California in 2023. If that's any indication, there were 715 zero emission semi sold in 2023, 685 are electric, 30 are hydrogen. It's very early days, but it's a trend which is going a certain way already.
I really do think batteries are definitely the way to do it. I mean, the costs really can get there. It's more of just like a product configuration, whereas I think with hydrogen, you're running into real technical barriers.
Okay, let's jump into electric and Revoid. You mentioned you're mostly doing robotics as a background. Could you give me a sense of what the product of Revoid looks like and how you got there?
Yeah, so it's definitely very visual, and I'll do a shameless plug, but also just for people to look at, you know, go to Revoid.com, R-E-V-O-Y.com, take a look at it. What it is, it's an electric vehicle. It looks like a trailer to the tractor, and it looks like a tractor to the trailer. So it's sort of a man in the middle. And what it does is it brings in renewable power in a pre-charged battery pack, which it has its own powertrain completely separate from the diesel. It puts out power on that powertrain on a set of wheels, which just lowers the amount of power demand from the diesel powertrain. And in that way, you're able to reduce fuel emissions. In a more practical sense, what it's doing is it's pulling the trailer for the truck, for the tractor. And what it will actually do is it can push the tractor. It can act as a third drive axle for the tractor and actually completely offset all of the fuel use by the tractor. So that's a recent milestone we actually hit, which is we can do 100% electric on the highway at constant speed. You just push the tractor, the fuel pumps turn off, and yeah, then what you're burning is just fuel to change speed, get onto the highway, get off the highway, and you can get just absurd levels of MPG. I mean, when you're burning zero fuel, that's infinite MPG, right? Mm-hmm. And so yeah, our record currently is 127 MPG. The baseline for a tractor trailer is 6. We can repeatably do around 80. So yeah.
These are crazy numbers. Yeah. And I think you gave a good image, right? It's mostly, it's 1/10 of the length of a trailer, more or less. And it comes in between, right?
Exactly.
That tractor and that trailer. And what I didn't know is that those connectors are standard. So that works on any semi-truck.
Yeah, it hooks up to a tractor like a trailer, just like a trailer. So it's the air brake system, the electrical system, the Stevex is called J560, and then it has a fifth wheel connection, so upper fifth wheel, which is the pin, the kingpin. And in the back, we have the lower fifth wheel. So it's sort of like a, you know, it mocks up the interface between each side of the vehicle. And yeah, it takes 2 minutes to hook up and can do any truck.
How did you come up with this idea? Because when I discovered Revoid, it's such an obvious idea. Mm-hmm. When you explain it this way of I'm just plugging in a battery behind a truck to pull the truck, that's a very intuitive idea. No one has done it before, though. So help me through the thought process from being at Cruise Automation, working on software for autonomy, to actually building this piece of hardware.
I'm a big generalist, honestly. I specialize in robotics, but inside of robotics, I do just about everything. And really what that came from was being in graduate school and you got to build the robot and you're doing it by yourself. And okay, I got to write some software. I got to build, spin a circuit board. I got to machine this part or design this robot. And so that's what I did at Cruise, especially early on. Later on, I really was focusing more on motion planning and remote assistance. But yeah, so I really wanted to take a stab at, you know, using that skill set, the ability to sort of take a multidisciplinary team and direct them towards conclusion, but also be on the product facing side, right? I was very much always on the engineering facing side, but I really wanted to connect those two. I was looking to found a company. And I was doing a lot of research on a lot of different fields. But in terms of the path that took me to Revoid, what it was is I was looking at construction robotics. So excavators, bulldozers, skid steers. And in researching that, I was looking into how do these things get to job sites. And I remember specifically, there was this one YouTube video where a guy, contractor, was talking about how to, you know, safely load a skid steer onto a trailer behind your pickup truck. And there's this bit of vehicle dynamics that I wasn't aware of, which is you never want to load the weight on the trailer behind the axle. You want to do it in front of. And the reason is there's some really cool videos out there, but it's dynamic. It's inherently and passively unstable. So you will fishtail and you will probably either flip or roll the vehicle if you do that. At the very least, you're going to have a bad time. And so the early concept was, hey, can we add some automation in like the hitch or the vehicle to make them safer? Make it like a smart tow assist, right? Mm. And I think you might be starting to see sort of the roots there. But sort of contemporaneously at the same time, you know, a lot of the cohort of, you know, my friends and you know, coworkers that it's funny, like I swear like half the graduating class of MIT moves out to Silicon Valley.
I would have said more.
Yeah. And so a lot of those people who, you know, we came out and people are working on web stuff and robotics and all this stuff, you know, everyone just started to get really concerned about climate. Honestly, I was a bit of a laggard, right? And specifically, my friend Peter Reinhardt, he leads Charm Industrial. In sort of us talking about Charm and him sort of really convincing me why it was an important thing to work on, I had this sort of aha moment of like, oh my gosh, my head has been in the sand. I think there was this idea of I'm a roboticist, like climate happens in the chemistry space and in the, honestly, I think a lot of it is a chemistry problem, but like, I can't really help with this. So I'm just going to go do my thing. I hope people figure it out. And that sort of background recognition of the problem, as well as the fact that, you know, as I was iterating on this trailer concept, the fact that if you added power to it and batteries, well, you could reduce fuel use. And that is something that all trucking fleets are looking to do. And also that's a huge emissions source. Well, there could be something here. Like we could maybe do that. And this is a, you know, piece of automation, a robot that instead of, you know, taking a human out like a self-driving car, it could be taking the fuel out and replacing it with electric power. And so the first version of the product, funnily enough, was basically take that, you know, automated trailer, but do it for industry, for tractor trailers, for heavy freight, right? Because that's the biggest impact source. And so it was an e-trailer. It was put batteries on the e-trailer, you know, put a powertrain on board, put a bunch of sensors in the front and offset fuel emissions that way.
Can I pause you there again? Because I think it's fascinating the point just made on the interlink between your background in robotics and how you felt like you didn't have a specific role to play in climate. Because this is something that I see a lot where, you know, I'm an accountant or I'm, I don't know, a biologist or a software engineer. I don't have the skills to actually do something about climate.
Yeah.
And what's truly fascinating is that the solution developed at Revoy is actually because of that unique profile and experience you have, right?
And it kind of just happened to be a climate solution, right? I was looking into building a robotics company.
Right. And a lot of those companies happen to do something for climate, but in the end, they are enterprise software. They are robotics companies with a climate impact to them. And at what point did you decide to make a company? Because you said you were looking to make a company, but at what point did you realize that this intersection between the trailer concept you were working on, the decarbonization concept, was something that could work? And at what point did you say, okay, that is actually a viable business to consider?
It's quite literally running the financial models and realizing it's a viable business. Yeah, the very first thing I built at this company was a financial model. This is true for all companies, right? Is like you need to have a pretty clear idea of how you're going to make money. I mean, you don't want to get 4 years in and have an oopsie and be like, hey, I mean, built something cool, but we can't get paid for it, right? Mm-hmm. No, you need to have a customer who pays, right? You need to have a customer who wants to buy the thing you're building.
How do you build that model with a high level of confidence? Is that a super complex Excel model that you inform from different market research, custom interviews, and how do you build that and you're confident enough to bet your career on it?
Yeah, great question. So you definitely need to come from a clear customer demand. I mean, so once I had a reasonable sense of it, you know, first thing I did was put up a website, get a brand name, start talking to customers, right? What I was validating was this assumption, which is, you know, fuel is a major cost in trucking. Trucking companies are always trying to reduce fuel. And so if we can bring them a product that can reduce their fuel use, well, they will want to buy it. And so, yeah, you have to talk to customers. You have to make sure that this is something they need. But that said, I mean, I was operating under that assumption, right? With the modeling of this is an important cost that they want to reduce. And so can we deliver a product that on the back end, you know, we can make profitable?
Do you cold call fleet owners and ask them about their needs and issues?
Cold calling is always hard. I mean, I'm a big fan of warm intros. I mean, definitely shout out Paul Gross. Like Paul Gross was very helpful in this regard. So yeah, thanks Paul. But yeah, warm intros are always the best way to get somebody to talk to you.
And how did you explain the product? Because you had a first idea of the product, but you didn't have any product. So
right.
How do you explain that to the fleet owners initially that, oh, I'm going to bring a trailer in the middle of your two trailers and then it's going to do all those kind of things.
Yeah.
Did that resonate with the fleet owners?
I build it at small scale. I mean, trucking in particular, for good reason, it's a very pragmatic industry and it's hard to sell a PowerPoint deck for sure. So I built a 1/14th scale version of the product running on a treadmill and showed fleet owners that and said, hey, we're going to build this at full scale. Are you interested? We're seeing about 80% fuel reduction on this version. Translates to this much cost savings for you. How much would you pay for that? Do you have customers who are asking for reductions in carbon? That's ultimately where a lot of the demand comes from, is that. So really, it's important to show.
And is that a toy? Like a model version of a...
Okay. One, yeah, 1/14th is very specific because that's the sort of most common RC version of semi-trucks, is they do it at 1/14th scale.
Okay.
So I did on an RC truck.
Got it.
Electric skateboard parts, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yep. But at least it's real. You can show something real.
Yes.
Okay, so that was your first, not product, but demonstrator. Let's say. Mm-hmm. Got a customer interested in it. And then from there, you decided to actually build a prototype.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. At that point, you know, especially with something this big, you know, you do need to have a reasonable amount of capital. This isn't something you can prototype in a garage. So thankfully, you know, we have great venture, you know, backers who really believe in the product and, you know, believe in what we can build. And that is very important. Climate is ultimately something in the world of atoms.
But that first product you built, I want to understand, like, how complex is it to build, right? Because... again, I think your website showed very well the product. There's a powertrain, so you're building a vehicle. There's a battery, so you're not building the battery yourself, but you're still integrating a battery. There's a bunch of software layers around it. There's some autonomy features to automatically connect. So there's a lot of systems on this product. I think you started the company in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
You released the official commercial product early this year, I believe.
Late 2023, but
late 2023, yes. So that's a 2-3 year product development timeline.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. What it is it's really a reformulated electric semi in terms of the components. It's a battery pack. There's an electric powertrain. And so a lot of that supply chain is translatable. So, you know, with a startup, this is the underlying thing with an MVP, right? It's oftentimes more about what you choose not to do versus what you actually do. I mean, you have to just ruthlessly reduce scope so that as a small team, you can actually get things done. In Taoism, there's this concept of, you know, do by not doing, right? And that really applies here. And so, yeah, don't reinvent the wheel on batteries or electric powertrain or anything. These all exist. And so we focused on, you know, what are the unique things? And really what it ended up being was just two core things. It's the smart kingpin instrumented hitch. We spent a lot of iterations on that. But then also, this was significantly less iteration, but was a moving from a other supply chain over to automotive was... since it's a one-axle vehicle on the road, when you decouple it, you need to have a deployable axle. So we actually sourced that from an aircraft landing gear company. So it's an aircraft landing gear. It actually sounds like an aircraft landing gear. And those are sort of the two unique components. Everything else, frame rails, batteries, all of that is basically, you know, existing supply chains. And so what we then focused on really was the software. You know, the software is really what makes it tick. That coordination with the driver in a very smooth and good user experience way definitely takes a good amount of time. And what you also want to have always through the whole development is mindfulness on safety, like really being careful about it. One of the things I'm most proud of is we have over 70,000 miles on the road with not a safety instance. We've never even been pulled over.
So let's talk a bit more about the customer experience. I saw on your website, you have very beautiful picture of Revoy swapping station. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you're calling them.
That's right.
But help me picture what that would look like in terms of a driver experience.
Yeah. So there's sort of two versions of this. There's once you're fully on the Revoy platform versus when you're first entering it. So when you first enter the Revoy service area, you're a standard diesel tractor trailer. You're a tractor connected via fifth wheel hitch to a trailer. And so what you do is you show up at a Revoy swapping station, and these are very much like you can imagine a traditional diesel truck stop. So a Pilot Flying J, a Loves, a TA, except instead of there being a fuel pump, what there is there's a stack of Revoy EVs that have been pre-charged. And when you show up, one pulls out, you drop your trailer, it comes and it grabs the trailer for you, and it hops onto the back of your truck, and then you go and you hit the road. That process takes 2 minutes. When you get onto the road, it provides extra power. So when you hit the accelerator pedal, it helps with that acceleration. When you hit the brake pedal, it applies regenerative braking and helps with that braking. It actually can stop the tractor trailer with 30% shorter distance. So just inherent safety win there that will prevent collisions. And then what's really cool is, and this is where the majority of the fuel savings come from, is when you hit constant speed on the highway, you take your foot off that accelerator and you just go. And it's really a magical experience. The engine goes quiet and all you hear is sort of a light electric whir, and the vibrations are lower and it's a much more peaceful experience. And then when your battery runs out, there will be a, and we intentionally place these Revoy swapping stations right when the battery runs out. Mm-hmm. You pull off the highway into this Revoy swapping station, Revoy truck stop. You park the truck. Once you come onto the lot, the Revoy pops off your truck. And this is sort of the, once you're already on the Revoy platform, the Revoy jumps off the back of your truck, parks the trailer, pulls off, goes and gets charged. And there's another stack of pre-charged Revoy EVs that one of them comes out, grabs the trailer, hops on the back of your truck, and then you go and hit the road. And that process takes 4 minutes. And you can basically do that endlessly, ad infinitum. And so our whole goal, I mean, connecting this to the early part of conversation, is long haul is the most important thing in trucking. And so this is how you do electric long haul. Our take on it is that electric is only a problem in terms of range, not because of the range itself. I mean, truckers will stop more frequently than that to go to the bathroom. You know, they're human beings, right? Mm-hmm. Go get a snack. The issue is that you're taking that truck down and that driver down for hours. And so with us, we've turned it into 4 minutes. And so you can just do that all day long. That's the whole operating model. And then in terms of how you pay us, it's just like a truck stop, right? So you pay for the energy and miles that you've used. And there's no upfront costs. You could have heard about it from a billboard 5 minutes ago. You show up, you hook it up, you go. That's how it works for a driver.
Fantastic. And so that seems amazing as a driver. How does that work for Revoy? Because you need to have the EVs ready.
That's right.
For when the drivers are coming. So if you already have a customer, mm-hmm. I imagine there's a platform for the customer to say, I will go from San Francisco to New York. And just like a Tesla supercharger, it will tell you, here are the 5 stops you can do with Revoy.
Exactly.
But then you need to make sure that those EVs are, there's enough of them and they're charged when this driver is coming. So I imagine there's some form of optimization of routes and charging time that you're doing in the back end.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's actually really where the vehicle itself provides a lot of benefit. So basically what I'd push back on is we actually inherently don't always have to have one ready and available. And it's because of this really awesome property of it, which is if it runs out of batteries, if you drop it off, you can still go on diesel. Mm. And so the way we usually structure our agreements with our customers is it's on a monthly basis, right? So if there isn't a Revoy available at that time, no big deal. Just continue on with diesel. And what we'll do is we'll make sure on average there will be Revoys available. And so what that does is it gives us a lot of flexibility on the back end to be able to really, you know, operate in a very lean capacity. You miss one guy coming down the road because it's not quite fully charged, you just get the next guy.
Right. Yeah. And that helps you a lot because your service level agreement is not this 99.9% availability, right?
Exactly.
As opposed to a charging station where if you're not available, that is a major problem. I can't keep going. I imagine another benefit for you is that you're able to charge off peak, right? Mm-hmm. Or whenever the energy is cheaper on that given grid, which you're not able to do if you just charge a truck because you have to charge it right now.
Yeah. I mean, with, for example, solar, right? The challenge with that is intermittency. You know, it only runs when the sun's shining, right? So I jokingly call our vehicles mobile stationary storage because that's what they are. I mean, we're building a solar farm in Arkansas, and in theory, we don't need any battery storage because we can just use the vehicles for storage and then just have them buffered up for customers. The other thing on the electricity side, like sourcing side of things, is we have a really different way of how we source it. And it comes down to the chicken egg problem on charging in vehicles. Believe it or not, we do not have a chicken or egg problem. And the reason is, despite our vehicle literally being a vehicle, in terms of the function of it in the market and in the industry, it's actually more, and not even more, it is a part of the charging infrastructure, not the vehicle infrastructure. And I'll use an example to illustrate this. So we have a route currently in Texas and Arkansas. It's actually part of a long haul route. That's one of the really cool things is we can start with subsections. Our customers go diesel into it and then diesel out of it. And then you just iteratively build it out. right now they come up from Laredo, Texas, going to Dallas. We hop on. They go to Prescott, Arkansas. We hop off. They continue on to Memphis on diesel. And then the same thing happens in reverse. So we hop on in Prescott and then go to Dallas, hop off. So our vehicles only go back and forth between these two points. Whereas the trucks coming through, they're going to any number of places, right? So our vehicles, and they're also getting swapped between different drivers, different fleets. They're not tied to the vehicles. They are locked to this lane. They're locked to this location. So they're like the chargers. They're at a location just like the chargers. And so what we're able to do is build charging immediately because the vehicles that, you know, we would be waiting on to come, they're already there. We charge up diesel trucks and there's already 3 million of those on the road.
And you're also putting those EVs when you know there's a customer demand for too. It. You're working with the customers, you're signing up.
Right.
They probably give you some key routes.
Exactly.
And then based on that, because it's fairly asset light locally, right, in terms of infrastructure needed.
Yes.
And then you're putting your EVs there sized accordingly to what the customer actually needs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we can get to, you know, we'll say, you know, quite high levels of revenue and unit profitability with two charging stations.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there some infrastructure locally, though? You still need to charge those EVs.
But that's the beauty, actually, is you really, like, one of the things a lot of charging is hung up on is two things. It's the interconnect queues with the utility and it's a distribution transformer. In general, though, we only do grid tying at low scales. When it comes to those high scales, we tend to go behind the meter and off grid.
Okay.
And the reason is we don't have to wait on the utility and we don't have to wait on the distribution transformers. Since we have the customers already coming in, well, okay, build a solar farm, build a natural gas generator, you know, build these little microgrids to service them. You get the cheapest power possible and you don't have to wait on these really slow other companies to get things done.
But you still need to wait for the project to come live.
That's true.
So you have a bit of a lead time in terms of that solar plant coming online, which can take probably more experience, like at least 6 months.
At least a year. Yeah. But I mean, compared to a 3 to 5 year interconnect queue.
Right. That's the world we live in. So yes, it's a good context. And I imagine when you're building those sites, you're also thinking of growth, right? So you're doing this for a certain customer today, but you're planning this for, I don't know, 10x more customers. So the charging facility and the solar plant or the wind plant that's behind it has to be able to scale accordingly.
That's the great thing about renewables is that they're very modular. So you start with 1 megawatt, then you go to 2 megawatts, then you go to 10, then you go to 100, and you can just do that all in phases. And that's the other benefit too of long haul is, I mean, try building a 100 megawatt solar farm at the port of Long Beach, right?
Right.
No way. No. you do that in you know, rural Arkansas, no problem.
Plenty of space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, you know, I was hitting at this before of, you know, that's why not only is long haul the biggest market, biggest emissions producer, it's also, in my opinion, the easiest market when it comes down to the economics, because you can do these things around electricity sourcing. But you do have to have this ability to actually directly source it.
You mentioned earlier 70,000 miles on the road today from the product you deployed earlier this year. I'd like to understand what kind of growth trajectory you're seeing and also how do you get to customers? Because I understand there is a natural lag because of the infrastructure deployment that you need to have in terms of swapping station and renewable deployments. But I'd love to understand where you are today and where you're seeing Revoy, you know, next year, next 2 years in terms of customer traction.
I think you talk to anyone in the trucking industry, what is basically common knowledge at this point is electric is significantly more expensive. And the issue with that is that there is a lot of demand for decarbonized logistics on the shipper end. There's a, you know, trucking is fundamental to the US economy. And every single good we have in this room, you know, came in on a truck. And all those companies, you know, need to be reducing their emissions. And so it's an opportunity for trucking fleets to be more sticky with those customers. You know, if you have that good decarbonized solution and your competition doesn't, well, that could be the difference maker in winning that contract, right? And that is what we're seeing, is helping trucking companies with Revoy partnerships earn new business, keep current business. You know, typical trucking contract cycles can be, you know, on the 3-year cycle, right? And so if you can keep that business, it removes a lot of risk. And yeah, so in terms of growth, you know, we're really going to be focusing on a few key locales, the Chicago area, the Texas for sure. Texas is a great place to do this, great place for solar. Mm-hmm. California is great as well. The Pacific Northwest, these are all places where we'll be deploying to customers. And the way we approach it is rather than taking this single network and growing it out, or maybe two networks, what we do is we do micro networks. I sometimes call them network kernels, which are these little two-ended networks that on their own can get to cash flow positive. And then you just leapfrog those one by one. And eventually we're going to merge this all into one big Revoy network. But the idea is do small scale, you know, several unit deployments, show the value and the really extreme emissions reduction. I mean, we're going to have a pretty cool emissions report come out later. And I guess I'll tease some of the results, which is very high NOx reduction above the level of fuel being burnt. And we're talking, you know, 10x improvement in fuel economy. And that's a basically elimination. And so that's something we can do. And yeah, that's the current expansion of Revoy. So you'll hopefully see Revoys on the road in your particular locale if you are in one of those areas.
I hope so. And we'll definitely link that paper whenever it's published.
Absolutely.
Interesting to hear this 10x. And I think it's a great point that it is a commercial value proposition in the end for your trucking company's partners, right? That is something that can make them win contract because you're differentiating in terms of embedded emissions of the goods that are transported.
Exactly.
And so for big companies, Nike, H&M, and so on, that have sustainability commitment, that matters for them for what we call the scope three. So exactly. The emissions of your suppliers, which include the trucking companies. So I can see how this is critical for them.
Exactly.
What are the barriers to growth today? Is it the time lag to infrastructure deployment? Is there a capital constraint maybe in actually getting those assets funded? It sounds like the customer pool isn't one of the constraints, but I'm curious to understand, like, what is the main barrier today?
Yeah, the main barrier, and I'd say this is almost general across a lot of climate tech and hardware tech, is especially with the new vehicle. You know, I said this earlier, but the goal is to make this bankable. It's a hard asset. It should be bankable. And so the key thing is you have to kind of vault this gap between your early product, your first revenue. In the banking space, they call it operational heritage, right? Proven cash flows, right? You have to take the time and prove out the cash flows. And then you can get debt at one interest rate, and then you get lower risk on the next interest rate. So that means a better rate, and so you can raise more. That's the main constraint, is basically working up the, we'll call it the debt ladder, right?
So by that, you mean that today you might be overpaying in financing costs for buying batteries, or even for financing renewable deployments?
Yeah.
Because you're a higher risk profile until you've deployed more and you're more bankable as a company yet.
Yeah, it's a common problem for like all assets, right? But especially with climate things, you know, if you're building a carbon capture plant, this is all new technology. And so it requires really traditional capital markets to fit into their risk profile. I think that's what every hardware company, but especially every climate company, will run into when they get into this growth stage of their company, is you got to make sure that the cash flows are good. Yeah.
Is there an unlock here, a gap in the market in terms of financing? What I'm asking is it just a structural issue where, you know, less proven, higher risk, higher interest rate profile makes sense? Or do you believe there's a space for catalytic investment or those kind of vehicles?
I do think there is a small gap, right? Like venture is very much at the early stages and, you know, debt is at the later stages. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, a lot of companies hit this point where they are in between, right? I think the idea is that DOE loans are supposed to fill that gap. The trouble with those loans is they typically only make sense for a lot of nitty-gritty reasons at basically like the 100 million mark. And so if you're not at that scale yet, right, you're on the own when as far as the DOE is concerned. There's grants, there's things like that, but when you start to talk about like real commercial widespread adoption, right, you need serious amounts of capital. And if you're below that threshold, it's this weird sort of like market non-linearity, if that makes sense.
It makes absolute sense because I hear a lot of first-of-a-kind discussion, which is it's hard to finance a first-of-a-kind asset. But what you're talking about is not first-of-a-kind. You're talking about this, you know, 1 to 50 or whatever the number is. And I hear this more and more among the climate tech community. The tech has been demonstrated, yep, but it's just a capital intensive technology. And just getting those other 10 or 20 facilities will be funded at a higher financing cost because of the risk profile of the company as an early company.
Exactly.
Interesting. Long-term vision for Revoy, 5-10 years. We have 3 million semis on the road today, 1,000 zero emission. What is the big picture vision?
Basically, we're going to be building truck stops. There's going to be, along with Pilot Flying J and TA and all it loves, there's going to be Revoy truck stops. You're going to see the Revoy horns on the side of the road. You know, you'll be able to go there and get snacks and do all the things. You know, you get it. There'll be embedded Taco Bells and all that stuff, right? It can be as small as you want facility. They do that on diesel. Or if it's a really big site, there's a sort of captive Revoy swapping station on board. But either way, you come onto the Revoy platform with your load and you can run on the Revoy platform all day long. Each of those sites will be supplied by renewable power. And what we will be doing is, as part of the trucking business, we will also be overbuilding that power supply. Our chargers can be used for passenger vehicles as well. So just like truck stops, we'll also fuel up passenger vehicles. We'll do EV semis too, if those are in the mix, light duty, whatever it may be. And we'll also overbuild and sell to local communities. I think there's a very convincing case to be made that with the modularity of renewables, which are by far the best new electricity generation to build, I mean, they're the best because they're the cheapest, right? And so electricity costs will come to be dominated by transmission costs. And so it's going to make more and more sense to have a local grid. And we want to build that local grid as part of first a trucking network, but then overbuild it and ultimately just be able to provide renewable power to anything that needs it. Homes, factories, whatever it may be. So basically, we want to be building the new renewable electricity infrastructure beyond just trucks. But trucks are the first thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was not expecting this. That is a beautiful vision that goes much beyond the trucking industry. And you're centering it more around the renewable assets you're actually building in those communities and how that's a cluster or a hub for many more opportunities around electrification.
Yes. And it's great that you call it a cluster and a hub because, I mean, sometimes in small areas, like rural areas, like that's a place where most people buy food, right? Mm-hmm. Like I want to really make this a real place, like a really awesome place for people to go. You know, like maybe we have a movie theater attached, maybe, you know, seriously, like just really make them awesome places. And since, you know, renewables are so much cheaper, right, there's just going to be more margins for stuff like that. So it can actually be a much nicer place.
Right. Two last questions. You transitioned from cruise to entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to hear about how you actually connected different ideas. What advice would you give to someone looking into launching a climate tech startup?
At a high level, I strongly believe that the only way you can make it work is if you can align a profit motive with carbon, either emissions reduction or capture. You know, I view those as sort of two sides of the same coin. You have to make it something that basically, regardless of it being renewable, people are interested in buying. So in our case, it's, you know, we reduce the fuel bill. Yeah, it just has to be a clear choice because if it's something that people are only buying because it's renewable, oftentimes that is not a strong enough thing for people to be buying, especially on mass. So definitely that. I would say I would really encourage people to look at hardware as the way to do it. My opinion on hardware startups is, I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like, you know, hardware startups, especially at the small scale, I think you make a very convincing case that they basically become the same, like software and hardware startups at, you know, public company level, but certainly at an early stage, I mean, you know, it costs so much less to build and so much less time to build a software product. But ultimately, we cannot get this done in the world of software.
If you were to start a new company today, so obviously not Revoy, not in trucking, what space are you most excited by?
Well, definitely distribution transformers. I'm dead serious about that. Like, if someone can figure out how to solve that supply constraint, like that is a big one.
And they will have every single utility as a customer.
Everybody. Yeah. It's the demand is so insanely high on it. So, I mean, I would definitely be taking a look at that. Let's see. I do think there's a lot of work that needs to be done on the sort of intersection of AI and specifically electrification when it comes to electricity supply. I do think it presents a hazard. AI data centers require a ton of power. When there's these long interconnect queues, it's just more things in the queue, right? And so it will slow down electrification. But I think that's only because of the way they are currently structured. And I do think there's ways to bridge that gap. Basically, if we could have shared infrastructure between GPUs and electric vehicles. The watts go to a GPU when you need to spin it up for training. And then when a truck shows up, you move it over there. And so maybe co-location of data centers and EV charging infrastructure. I don't have the solution for it, but it's something I do think needs to be solved. And I think it presents a major, major challenge.
Interesting. I think what you're talking about is like load management of data center. I know Google has done some of that work in terms of balancing load across data center and time of the day, depending on like the carbon intensity, the availability of energy.
Yeah.
There's probably more to be done. I like this idea of not just thinking of the data center on its own, but with regards to other energy users. So interesting idea.
Yeah. And I hope it sparks some ideas in people because I certainly don't have the solution to it. But another one too, maybe just to put a point on it, is that like until we put a price on carbon, you know, the price of carbon is going to be more far off. You know, it's there, but you know, it's on the decades timescale. And so similar to the idea of, you know, you got to align the profit motive. Like if you're, you know, to your point, if you're an accountant, if you're a software engineer, whatever you may be, I mean, ultimately, you know, our society runs on energy. You know, I think there's a convincing argument that like, you know, you look at the growth of our society and the energy usage and like per capita energy usage is kind of a driver of like quality of life, you know? And we certainly all use a lot of energy. We all do it. We all use it. And if you really do want to make an impact, like look for those ways that in your day-to-day, like I'm not talking about like, you know, you need to recycle and you need to like, you know, take public transit. I'm talking about in your influence at your organization, you know, how will higher CO2 levels affect you and your company? As well as how can, you know, the sets of technologies we have now really benefit you? As maybe a final point to that of like, you know, similar to the startup space is like, in general, even just like, just for everybody, we need to be like less afraid of making mistakes. We need to be less afraid of trying something and failing. It's better to have tried and failed something to have to do just nothing at all. And so, you know, incentive structures need to sort of come around to that, but that's a bigger thing.
On that note, Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Florian.
I think it was really fascinating to hear first how you translated your experience from Cruise to building a product, which in structure is similar in terms of aggregating different subsystems and having a software layer on top of it. Your points around developing a network piece by piece also that is not necessarily connected initially is really interesting. I think a good lesson for all of us around the bankability and how do you make sure that whatever idea you're going for has a clear profitability angle in addition to whatever climate impact it might have, which the climate impact might not resonate with some of your customer base. The profitability and bankability will resonate. And definitely surprised and very excited to hear about the broader vision you brought around those clusters, those hubs, enabling electrification of trucking, of course, but also going much beyond trucking. I look forward to seeing those horns in California on the I-5 or on other major corridors. But it's been a fantastic discussion.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Florian.
Congratulations, you finished this episode. Thank you so much for listening until the end. And if you liked it, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a 5-star review. This is really helpful to be more visible in the rankings and to be able to keep inviting the best of climate tech entrepreneurs in this show. Thank you so much. And I'll catch you on our next episode very soon.